I did see where the fire department here received a grant for preventative activities.
We apply for a lot of grants.
Yes, yes.
Any of us who have to do fire prevention or buy equipment all out of our general fund, look for whatever avenues that are out there to do that. And we really pride ourselves on the amount of not only training we can do for our own employees, but the amount of education that we can do at sororities and fraternities, dorms on campus, in the general public. So we do apply for those grants whenever they come up, and sometimes we're really successful and can do more projects than we had anticipated.
It's been more than a year. I think it was a year ago last May where you had the big fire.
Oh my gosh,
downtown.
Yes, we did.
It's been some time has passed. Has anything from that spawned new activity or new prevention activities for downtown?
Well, I think one of the things you'll see, and I don't know if you and I have had a chance to talk about this, but the businesses are back. And they have rebuilt. And I was in the dentist's office, Dr. Perry Wainman's office. He opened up 2 weeks ago now. And as we walked through there, he said, the one thing I am very, very sure about now is that the fire prevention that we have now in place in this building will keep us safe. So old buildings, there was a lot of repeat on ceilings. There were shared walls that weren't well insulated. There weren't fire suppression systems. The rebuilding that has gone on has enabled, because you have to come up to current code, those buildings to come up to code. And most certainly that has made a dramatic change in terms of the safety and the viability of those edifices again. So I think everybody is excited about that, and it looks wonderful. And when we look at the before and after pictures from May 17th to July 17th, 2014, it's incredible, and it's a testimony to people's perseverance and actually working together, because three of those are facade projects that we're still finishing up from our Stellar grant.
I wanted just to touch briefly on crime too in the state. We've heard a lot of coming from Indianapolis lately. Obviously, you hope that that doesn't start to creep out into neighboring cities and so forth. Greencastle being right off I-70, not terribly far from Indianapolis. Does this raise a concern for you in the community here?
You know, I think we are all very cognizant about what's happening in larger cities and concerned about that. And what are the things that we need to look for in terms of how do we protect our local community and keep it safe? I think some of the things that we have done and make it an issue for us on a regular basis is obviously the training of our law enforcement officers and making sure that we are well staffed, that we have a reliable group of reserves who can fill in when our full-time officers are on vacation or ill and not able. We've gone to 12-hour staffing, which has beefed up our 24-hour staffing 7 days a week. And that has been, you know, with the knowledge that we need to be out on the streets. I think we've also worked really hard to talk about what we can do as neighbors. When we go into the wards and have meetings, we talk about neighborhood watch programs and how to develop those and encourage those to happen. I've got two more ward meetings coming up, one in August and one in September, and our police chief, Tom Sutherland, will go with me and explain the program and give people the resources they need and certainly act as their conduit if they feel that that's something that they would like to take advantage of. So I think we need to mobilize our community. I think we need to make sure our law enforcement officials are well-staffed and that they're well-trained. And I think we need to keep our eyes and ears open in terms of areas that might be causing issues or problems. We work hard to try and provide recreational activities, keep our youth occupied. I think they're all pieces and parts of a larger puzzle, I think, that we've all been debating. It's just not just crime and access to weapons. It's the idea of how do we grow a culture of people who really do look out for each other and are concerned about the well-being of their neighbor.
Speaking of recreational activities, this past July, one of the coolest months on record, and then here we go and open a beautiful splash pad that we just saw in on the way from town, and just a big grand opening last night. How did that go?
Big grand opening. It was a wonderful grand opening, and actually, you're right. I mean, coolest July on record, which did hit revenues at the pool pretty significantly. But yesterday was a perfect summer day, and people did, by the hundreds, come and take advantage of it. I think what had happened to us is that our infant pool, there had been a lot of new regulations that had been put forth, safety issues that the state had said are really important. And it's not that we didn't agree that they were important, but we didn't have the resources to rebuild and to make the modifications that they had asked for. So we actually had to close down our baby pool a couple of years ago. And then we had a group of young women who said, you know what would be really nice, we'd like to take on as a project, is a whole idea of putting in a splash park, which obviously gives young children and toddlers a place to be, and you don't have the same concerns about lifeguarding and access that you do in a pool situation. So the idea sprung up about 3 years ago. They worked diligently with our park and rec director, because it is within the confines of our city park, and they applied for a DNR grant, and that DNR grant paid for the majority of the splash park. We were able to get a lot of in-kind donations from, you know, a cement maker, from lumber company, from carpenters, from excavating experts. So we had a lot of in-kind work that came our way and a lot of generous citizens. The city council put in, if they needed, up to $100,000 to finish off the project to make sure it would be done. And it all culminated last night. We had some great work done by Hannum Wagelin Klein as our engineers on the project, and R.L. Turner was the construction company, and everybody worked really well together, and it was a fast track, actually. This whole thing came up and was turned on, as you alluded to last night, and we actually did that in about 4 months, which is pretty quick for a DNR project and pretty quick to move city government along, let alone construction. So the cool weather helped us with the splash park. The other thing that this helps with, quite honestly, is that majority of our lifeguards are students. And so those students are heading back to school, which means our pool closing is next week. And those of us who spend late summer and early fall in Indiana know that that can be a pretty sultry time. So the splash park allows us to have a water feature that will be accessible and open. And the other positive thing about that is it's free. So people don't have to worry about paying to get in. If it's a hot day, they can go over after school and enjoy it. And so I think it's going to be a very positive addition to the park. And, you know, this very large village created a wonderful new amenity for our park system.
How much does the aquatic center there, the mm-hmm. pool, rely on admission cost for operation? Because, I mean, as you said, it's been cool, so the admission funds are going to be much lower, I would assume.
Well, it's admission funds, and it's also concessions. You know, people come to the pool, and they want to eat, they want to have beverages. So we make money on our concessions, we make money on the number of people who are accessing the pool, whether it be through season passes or daily admittance. But when they're not coming, we have product left over that we've expended money for. We have lifeguards that we try to control the flow of who's working and who's not, so we don't overstaff on those days. But we have a pretty hefty payroll through the summer, and we need to be able to support that. I think, like any park and recreation program, we need to break even. It's not that we're hoping to make lots and lots of money on it, but we minimally have to break even on that. So that's even been a challenge this year.
See, one of your major road arteries, Indiana Street, is almost ready to be
open.
Oh my
goodness, almost ready. We've got two layers of asphalt on it. My public works folks are continuing to plant trees along the roadway today. They will be laying the final asphalt, in about a week and a half. They have a little bit of decorative work still to do. The light poles aren't up yet. And an alley that connects both Indiana Street and the next parallel street over Vine Street that runs north and south has an alley that's created lots of problems in the winter months, especially with pooling water, which ices over, makes it impassable, and a lot of people use it for a walkway as well as some deliveries. So that is being completely reconstructed also. So we still have some concrete pouring to do on the side of that, but there is now a trench drain down the middle, and all of the downspouts are tied into that trench drain, and so we'll be able to finish that off and pour the last layer of asphalt and open it up, hopefully, by the 21st.
And this is all part of the Stellar Grant.
Stellar Grant.
That we always enjoy getting updates about. Something I read about, too, that I thought was interesting were funds available for residents downtown to be able to improve homes.
The owner-occupied rehabilitation program through Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, they have money that is allocated every year as a home assistance program. And it, in our case, has been a grant program to people who meet the HUD guidelines that are established by IHCDA, Indiana Housing. We work with STAR Development, who's our grant administrator on that. And initially in the Stellar Grant, we were awarded potentially up to $1 million to do this owner-occupied rehabilitation. The parameter with it comes that the first thing you have to do is identify and remediate lead-based paint. So that has to be done on all homes. But if you own your home and if you meet the income guidelines, once that lead paint remediation has been accounted for and taken care of, then you're pretty well free to decide what kind of things, what kind of improvements your house would need. So we've had people who have done flooring, we've had people who have done bathrooms upgrades, kitchen upgrades, roofs, windows, doors, porches, ramps, a whole variety of things. And people have gotten almost up to $20,000 in some cases to do those improvements. They're run through the IHCDA program, they're carried through by STAR Development, and the homeowner actually works with the contractor and STAR supervises, and they have a project when it's finished that everybody is pretty proud of. Initially, we were targeted in the Stellar area, and we found, we're in the second round right now, that we have pretty well tapped out the people who are income eligible who actually own their home. We have a number of rental properties through that area. The university owns housing in that area. And as a result, I had applied to IHCDA to expand it throughout the city so we didn't have dollars to turn back. And so we're taking those applications in now. And today I can tell you I don't think we're going to have any grant dollars left at the end of the day. So it's moving along, and it's a wonderful program. It's one of those that it's too good to be true. You know, people say, well, when do I pay it back and what percentage? And you tell them, you know, you don't. And we have some in-kind things we're going to ask of you, but the first time we did it, it was learning how to landscape your house and give your house some more curb appeal, if you will. This time it has to do with following through on some kind of a safety plan, a fire safety plan, and in making sure smoke detectors are installed appropriately. So it's a good program.
And speaking of the university, it's August. Are you bracing yourself for the return
of students?
They're coming back, right?
For those of us who virtually live on campus, you really notice a difference in the summertime. Just the vehicular difference and the people walking up and down the streets. But on August the 23rd, the first year students will be coming in with their parents. And upperclassmen will be coming in later that week, and then classes will be starting. So the tempo and pace of the community will change quite a bit. And of course, when we've got the bookstore downtown for DePaul students, we get a lot of traffic down that Indiana street. And so that's why there's been a real push to get that open before opening day.
You know, we did notice the recent Princeton Review Party Schools came out. DePaul.
Yes, it did.
Made the top 20.
Yes, they did. I think they were the Indiana school that did make the top 20. You know, it was interesting. I was looking some more today at the U.S. News and World Report, and they have their rankings out on colleges. And I think one of the telling things that comes with that kind of a ranking is the percent of Greek population that you have on the campus. And, you know, the women's sorority population on DePaul's campus is, it's above 65 but below 70, and the fraternity population is up over 70%. And I think for better or for worse, Greek systems are sometimes equated with a different level of partying, if you will, that goes on. And I think DePaul has been a Greek-affiliated school for a long time, not as much as it used to be. And so there's an anticipation. You know, again, I live next door to a Greek house. So, you know, it has ebbs and flows, but, you know, so do many college campuses identified in different ways. But I think there is in these rankings some kind of a direct correlation with Greek affiliation.
What else am I missing?
It's budget time.
Is it?
It's budget time.
I was reading that.
Yeah. And I think all of us are, you know, working hard and bracing for what we know is going to be another difficult budget year. Golly, we're being told to anticipate another decrease in our AV. And just as you know, we put our numbers together, anticipate less income coming in from both your property taxes, your certified shares. Even if the AV goes down and your tax rate drops, we still have those people who are bumping against property tax caps. So I think we have a lot of concerns. Health insurance is still one of those questions that we all have in terms of what's the increase going to be in 2015 and how is that going to affect our budget. We have people that we'd like to give raises to who work very hard 12 months a year and we never pay them quite enough. So we try to juggle all those things, the need for capital equipment, the need to have infrastructure in place and functioning properly, and the need to be able to take care of what people in the community expect from us. So it's a balancing act that I think we're all just really hoping that we're guessing right, that maybe the revenues will come in better than anticipated, and there's still an awful lot of discussion about the business personal property tax and what's going to happen with that and what those effects in 2015 are going to be and what is the legislature going to do as they go ahead and try to formulate a budget. I think there's a lot of fear as we go through that budget process and hard decisions to make.
Where are you at right now today with the budget?
What we do now is we do our best estimate on what we need to get through next year. You know, how much product is it going to take to keep the streets passable in the winter months? You know, how many people are we going to need to have employed to have the park pool open? I mean, just a lot of questions like that. And how we've typically done it and what we've done thus far is I've met with each of my department heads and we've talked about what are the needs. You know, when we look at general fund, when we look at specialized tax levies, what are the needs of your department? And let's realistically look at them, knowing the sky isn't the limit and we have to live within our means. And then we put that together and we have a tax rate that's established for us. And then we have to wait until next year before our actual budget is approved. So we have to anticipate what we need. What my job is going to be is to talk with my department heads about, listen, we're going to be in the best shape possible if we don't spend out our 2014 budget. You know, we want to have money left at the end of the year so we have cash to start with. If we don't have that cash to start with, we've painted ourselves in a corner where we're going to have to make difficult cuts. And so we have tried to adhere to that over the past 6.5 years. I'm planning on doing the same thing now and hope revenues come in a little better and we're going to continue to balance. Quite frankly, you know, I think where we are right now in terms of decreasing property taxes, AVs that can be questioned and can be reduced, puts us all in a very difficult place with no replacement revenues available. I mean, that's the uncomfortable part. There's not another place to go. And, you know, building permits and fees don't make up $1 million in loss of taxes. So, you know, people still have the same interest and still want the same things from the community they live in. They want to be safe, just as we were talking about. And certainly public safety is a big part of my budget, just like it is the Indianapolis budget. So we work hard to be frugal, to save as much money as we can, to give what we can to our people, and to be flexible enough to realize it takes partnerships, just like I mentioned with DNR and the grant and the Civic League that raised money and people who are willing to donate to make things happen. It's why we've got the splash pad. It's not because of our revenue. So that's how communities are going to survive. And the hard part's going to be when we can't do that kind of thing anymore, when we can't keep our policemen on the street, when we can't keep a full-time fire department.